You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook.
This has been reflected in the politics of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, the $1 billion to the richest people and tax breaks and the cutting of all the social programs, and so that you have devastation, destitution, and desperation at the bottom, which then becomes reflected in the tearing up of social relations, family, crime, and a more oppressive state control in order to maintain this oppressive system.
People's Tribune Radio provides a source of revolutionary audio programming to people interested in changing society. It is produced in association with the newspaper People's Tribune and the bilingual magazine Tribuno del Pueblo. On this edition of PT Radio, we open the door to Hurricane Katrina. We attempt to establish an understanding as to why and how such devastation can occur in the wealthiest country in the world. A place where freedom and democracy is supposed to forget about no one and nobody is forgotten? Can this myth really hold up to the travesty of Hurricane Katrina? How does race and class play out during and following the hurricane? The hurricane did more than breach the flood banks of New Orleans, kill thousands, and destroy millions of homes. The natural disaster, coupled with the U.S. government's inaction, opens the door to understanding how poverty and class operates in this, the wealthiest, most influential country in the world. Political science professor at the University of Pennsylvania and a member of the Labor Party National Council, Adolf Reed, grew up in New Orleans. He shares with us a statement that the Labor Party wrote in response to Hurricane Katrina.
The unfathomable horror in New Orleans is not simply a natural disaster, the result of bad fate, a blind act of God. It's the product of conscious, willful political action and inaction. It's not simply a humanitarian crisis. It's a devastating expression of a political crisis that's been brewing for decades. And the right wing in this country has methodically pursued a strategy of, as anti-tax guru Grover Norquist put it, shrinking government, in his words, until it's small enough to drown in the bathtub. Well, New Orleans just became the bathtub. It's been known and widely reported for years that the levee system in New Orleans needed extensive upgrading, and that the project's magnitude is so great that only the federal government has the capacity to undertake it. It's also been noted all along that not making those improvements was a recipe for a disaster, precisely like what's happened. Nevertheless, the Bush administration cut the levee project's budget by 44% to divert funds to the war in Iraq in 2004. To add insult to injury, he now faces the American people and boldly lies that he could have had no idea the levee might fail. And not only did his policies make the city more vulnerable, they also undercut emergency response. The Louisiana and Mississippi National Guards, the first line of response, are severely understaffed because at least a third of each state's personnel have been sent to Iraq. And with the aid of a Republican Congress and abetted by go-along Democrats, he's marginalized the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Although it had been known for nearly a week that Hurricane Katrina was going to make landfall somewhere on the eastern Louisiana or Mississippi Gulf Coast by Monday, and New Orleans was filling with water by Monday night, as of Wednesday, Bush had not mobilized federal support. Wednesday, after 80% of New Orleans had been inundated for approaching 48 hours. Real federal support didn't arrive until Friday, 4 days after the levee ruptured, and even that was half what Louisiana's Governor Blanco had requested. The escalating catastrophe should be laid at the feet of the Bush administration and the bipartisan consensus that for more than two decades has been disparaging and gutting the public sector, shrinking and eliminating public functions, and undermining any notion of social solidarity. The Bush administration has radically intensified and expanded the right's agenda of reducing government to a vehicle for enhancing plunder by corporations and the wealthy and for punishing everyone else. Their problem isn't just incompetence or even lack of empathy, though there's abundant evidence of both. We are experiencing the most naked, borderline thuggish class rule that we've seen in this country in at least a century. And as is so often the case in America, racist demonization helps them pull it off. Today it's the poorest and weakest of New Orleanians who can be left to die on parched overpasses or in fetid, toxic snake and alligator infested water. Because they're black, they can be stigmatized as looters or welfare cheaters who are too lazy to evacuate. Who will it be tomorrow?
We begin to look at race and class to understand how they shape the events around Katrina. Adolf Reed speaks about race in relation to class.
To paraphrase the historian Barbara Fields, race in America is a language through which class contradictions have commonly been expressed. Race is a marker, right? It's a marker of where people sit, where people stand in the society. I think because of the history of slavery and white supremacy in this country, race is a convenient language that's available to try to understand difference or to impose or to suggest notions of fundamental difference between people. It's possible, to look at these people who got screwed in New Orleans and say, well, they must have done something wrong because of who they are, right? I mean, the whole looting narrative, I think, was a part of that, right?
The editor of the Tribunal del Pueblo, Lara Garcia, speaks a little about a race-class dichotomy.
I've also seen the news and I've talked to some of my friends, and the question comes up about, oh, it's race, and then other people say, no, it's class. Frankly, it's both. I mean, to me, it's a false dichotomy because it is a class question, because the capitalists will defend and protect their own and its economic system. And it is racism because you cannot deny the legacy of slavery. Nonetheless, I assure you that they would take care of themselves and their interests first and foremost, and then take care of the rest of the population.
Adrian Garcia, a volunteer from Chicago, traveled to Mississippi and Louisiana.
It's interesting, the class issue that's going on down there. And, I would even ask people, in my interviews, it'd be like, the media's putting a lot of blame on the response towards racism. They're really feeding the national audience that. And I was like, what do you have to say about that? And they're like, no, it ain't racism. Like, what it is it's racism against the poor.
New Orleans native Walda Katz Fishman is board chair of Project South and a professor at Howard University. She provides an idea as to how race and class operate around New Orleans.
I think that New Orleans is a unique city. It gave birth to blues and the jazz. It was this, incredible mix of peoples from all continents of the world. And it was a rich cultural and a rich social community that was in New Orleans. And it's one of the oldest communities that we have in this country. But you have a very racially polarized community along with a very economically polarized community. And I think in New Orleans, that 60% of New Orleans that we saw that had really been abandoned and that was having a very difficult time getting out is that coming together of race and poverty that was really hidden. They were the lower ninth ward in Treme and in those neighborhoods. And, they are like hidden from the normal view, but they are really the history and the life of the city. That has always been a piece of New Orleans, is this really intersection of race and class, of black poverty, but also you have white poverty is in New Orleans, but it's further out. So that, this racial and this class divide is very pronounced in New Orleans.
Adolph Reed.
As my own family experience makes clear, while class doesn't provide perfect insulation against a natural disaster, as natural disasters often are, partly the product of human action and inaction, class does provide something of a layer of insulation against the worst. I think that people have talked a lot about race. You can see the obvious racial disparities in all the photos and the like about who's suffering most in New Orleans. But I'll bet you that when the dust settles down, we'll see that class understood as income and wealth and access to resources, including connections, like cars that get out of town and family members who've got space to put you up elsewhere, who you can communicate with, some cash you can get hold of and so forth and so on, that at every step along the way, class is going to turn out to have been a better predictor of outcomes than race. Class will be a better predictor of who survived. Class will be a better predictor of who was able to evacuate. Class will be a better predictor of who got stuck in a Superdome with no food and water, and who was able to get buses out of town. And above all, the people who are most conspicuously, most obviously, and tragically swept to the side, outrageously swept to the side in the aftermath of the storm, are the same people who were just as outrageously swept to the side in normal times, right? The people who were the low-wage props for the consumer, or for the tourism industry and part of the Industrial Reserve Army, who didn't even have those jobs.
This is People's Tribune Radio. We begin to shift towards Katrina's exposure of poverty. New Orleans evacuee and an editor with Left Turn magazine, Jordan Flaherty, comments on poverty.
It's not just the hurricane of Katrina that people talk about. In fact, I think that's a very small part of what we're dealing with. It's what Cornel West called Hurricane Povertina. It's this hurricane of neglect and corruption and poverty and deindustrialization and disinvestment that really hit New Orleans.
Another evacuee and the director of Loyola University's Twomey Center for Peace Through Justice, Ted Kwan, discusses a hurricane of poverty that existed in New Orleans prior to Katrina.
I think the hurricane happened in a moment and the flood happened in a moment, but the disaster that's happening to poor communities around this country has been happening for decades.
Walda Katz-Fishman.
What's really happened is a lot of historic realities of the South, very deep poverty, very intense racism or white supremacy. Militarism is very strong in the South. Most of the military bases are there. And there's been a real abandonment of the South and a letting go of the infrastructure, right? I mean, so all of the indicators of social well-being have always been much worse in the South. So when nature brought Katrina to New Orleans, all of those things kicked in to create a disaster of, you know, really almost unimaginable proportions.
Ted Quant moved to New Orleans in 1970. During that time, he had no problem finding a $7 an hour job in a factory or along the Mississippi River. $7 was well over the $1.25 minimum wage. He shares with us how competing for jobs with the people abroad has brought down wages in the U.S. and changed the history of the middle class lifestyle.
And if I got fired from one job or laid off from a job, you know, the next day you go out and you got another one. By the 1980s, someone had to die on the river for you to get a job. Everything is containerized. Thousands of jobs wiped out, but the price of labor is dropping to the price of the lowest worker in the world. And at this point, there are a billion people that work for $1 a day. So I think we're looking at an economic system that, with globalization and a philosophy that says the market will determine the value of things and people. If you don't have a market value in a society where your labor is no longer necessary, then you have no value whatsoever. And this is then reflected in the politics of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. The $1 billion to the richest people in tax breaks and the cutting of all the social programs, and so that you have devastation, destitution, and desperation at the bottom, which then becomes reflected in the tearing up of social relations, family, crime, and a more oppressive state control in order to maintain this oppressive system.
The system's efforts to ignore the poor are further expressed in government's lack of action surrounding the hurricane. Ex-member of the Black Panther Party and Green Party candidate for New Orleans City Council, Malik Rahim, weathered the storm in the community of Algiers. He speaks about how people could be forgotten during such a severe storm.
Neglect, abandonment, you know, totally disregard. And that's from the mayor of New Orleans all the way to the president of the United States. There's no one more guilty than the other. From the governor, her main concern was restoring order instead of saving people's lives, to the mayor, who even refused to do a forced evacuation that this storm was coming, to the president, who was real late on bringing in aid.
And a lot of us are very angry, needless to say, because not only of the loss of life and the disaster that, you know, people are feeling, but because we knew that this was going to be coming and there was no leadership to do the kinds of preventative things and then the kinds of planning things that would have lessened the human toll of this storm.
When you're from someplace like New Orleans, people kid with me about this a lot, is come June 1st, part of my mind's eye just sort of goes out into the Atlantic and starts picking up and following tropical depressions all the way through the Caribbean to see if they go into the Gulf, all the way through the Gulf. And the last two or three years, you know, there were more hurricanes and more intense hurricanes than there have ever been in my lifetime, and I'm 58 years old. You know, every year for more than 5 years, the Times-Picayune has done a big feature article on how vulnerable the levee system is and what could happen to the city if a major Category 3 or Category 4 storm hit the city. There have been articles in the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times, Washington Post, a big article in National Geographic.
Jordan Flaherty.
The federal government and state government knew that the levees needed to be shored up, needed more funding. Army Corps of Engineers asked for $105 million just in this last year, and the Bush administration cut it to $40 million.
As I grapple with this tragic situation, the most difficult aspect for me to comprehend is not only that our government knew, but much of the death and destruction occurred following the hurricane, a time when one would think relief efforts would be saving lives. Katrina Volunteer from Florida and director of The Refuge, a shelter for the poor and homeless, Reverend Bruce Wright.
We saw a number of neighborhoods that have been beleaguered long before there was any kind of storm due to poverty and oppression at the hands of the powers that be by not investing in their communities and creating the infrastructure that's necessary to be able to sustain them in such a crisis as what happened with Hurricane Katrina. So it's a real difficult situation there. A lot of them are extremely, extremely angry. They feel like this catastrophe could have been diminished had there been proper infrastructure and support of these low-income neighborhoods, knowing that much of the support they had been taken away to fight this war in Iraq and to just continue to build up and feed a bloated military budget, as well as taken away tax base by giving these tax cuts, you know, that have come about for the wealthy.
What we saw was the infrastructure collapsing. It was not the hurricane that did it. It wasn't the high winds. It wasn't high waves from a hurricane. It all took place in the day after the hurricane, when the levees broke and the flooding began. In the days after that, when we saw the rescue not coming, the people of the Ninth Ward and the lower Ninth Wards, the poorest areas of New Orleans, saw the helicopters going overhead, but nobody rescuing them.
The people left behind were still left behind. So what was the plan for them? Well, get to the Superdome. Get a friend to take you, whatever. But there was no plan for them. Go to the Superdome so you can be surrounded by a moat of toxic water and be unable to escape, can't even flush a toilet.
What folks need to remember is the Superdome and the Convention Center were not being flooded. It was a horrible, horrible situation for people, but there was not flooding, which means people could have left. If the government had gotten buses in, they could have taken people out. And in fact, people tried to walk out, and shots were fired over their head, and they were chased off by armed folks over in the sort of white flight suburbs outside of New Orleans. They chased people off. They did not want this black mass getting out of the city. And the government was not sending buses to get people out. It would not have taken massive millions of dollars. All it would have taken is just some buses, and you could have taken people out. And people were there for 5 days, 6 days, just waiting to get out, just living in filth with no toilets, with very little food and water. It was a horrible, horrible situation that people suffered under. And people in the shelters who did make it out, they said, "We felt we were being left to die. We felt we were being left behind." And that's what New Orleans has had for the last several years, is they've been left behind by the federal government, by the state government. We have the lowest rates for almost everything in the country. We have the worst healthcare system in the country, the worst schools in the country, the worst salaries for teachers, the highest incarceration rate of any state in the U.S. If Louisiana were a country, it would be the highest incarceration rate in the world.
The plan should have been to mobilize as Cuba does when they get ready to have a hurricane. Every resource of the government is organized to take the people and move them into safe shelters. Cuba gets hit with every hurricane that hits the United States. Why is it that they were able to offer doctors to America instead of the other way around? Because they care about the 100% of people, not the 60% or the percent of people that can take care of themselves. And so the people in New Orleans didn't even have buses to take them to the Superdome.
This is People's Tribune Radio. The aftermath of Hurricane Katrina has exposed undeniable discrepancies within our current government. The lack of response is no accident. We begin to look at how government policy has influenced the public response to Katrina. Policy analyst, author, and activist, Antonia Yuhas.
People all along the Gulf Coast have written out the plans, the policy requirements, what it would be needed to protect the coast from a hurricane, just like Katrina, completely expected, completely planned for. And not only has the funding not been there, but the Bush administration was about to gut even further the funding for plan for hurricane protection in the very states hit by Katrina, in the budget prior to Katrina hitting, so that the situation would have been even worse had this process continued forward.
As we look further, we begin to see a trend forming that's beginning to eliminate the social safeguards. Again, New Orleans native Adolph Reed.
In two of the hospitals where people drowned in the city of New Orleans, they couldn't evacuate people by helicopter because the budget had been cut. Bobby Jindal, when he was head of the state hospital authority, slashed because he wanted to close public hospitals.
It's true that whatever lives were saved were saved mostly by individuals that went out. I met one person, a couple, that saved, they estimate, more than 100 people by boat, going out, giving people food, giving people rides. The government was not there for people, and it's not because it's not possible to build up an institution where people put into it and it takes care of those that are less fortunate. It's because the neoconservatives have destroyed this idea of any sort of system of government that can be of any use to anybody.
Antonia Juhas.
Simply a question of a structural adjustment here at home, basic policymaking that directs resources away from vital public interest, vital public necessity, and instead shifts it to the war, shifts it to paying $50 billion in U.S. money to U.S. corporations to do terrible work in Iraq, to the tax cut, to everything else. Katrina is, unfortunately, the future. It's not a coincidence that the devastation of the tsunami in East Asia and the devastation of Katrina happened one after another. It was the same policies put in place in all the tsunami-affected countries, forced deforestation, forced removal of communities that had sustainable living practices on the coast to create tourist communities on the coast with completely unsustainable practices of beach erosion and reef erosion, economic policies that made the devastation of the tsunami significantly worse than it would have been are the same policies put in place that made Katrina significantly worse than it would have been. And with, of course, global warming, we can anticipate more such climate changes. But the climate changes being the impacts of climate change and the storms that we know it's going to create are being made that much worse by policy decisions that we're making here at home.
As climate change increasingly impacts our surroundings, we will need a government who not only values life in times of a disaster, but a government brave enough to implement and enforce sustainable policies. Walda Katz-Fishman speaks to the impact of privatization exposed from Hurricane Katrina.
And I think the collapse of the governments at all levels, to have any kind of an evacuation plan, to have any kind of an efficient or an effective, immediate disaster relief plan, their failure to take care of the infrastructure, the levees, the wetlands, all of that was the private sector saying, we want profits as a very short-term bottom-line thing, and tax cuts were given instead of levees being shorn up. Wetlands were allowed to be destroyed for development purposes. And all of these private, corporate-driven initiatives really destroyed the ecology of the area. And then the human services that would have been provided to people to take care of them both while they were there, but to get them out of the city. The privatization of healthcare and of education and even the privatization of the military and now the subcontracting out and the privatization of our emergency preparedness arms of this government, that it doesn't work. I mean, I think what the Gulf Coast and New Orleans really show to us is that privatizing these different essential services and functions that are necessary for society do not work. If anything proves that this privatized neoliberal project of taking care of corporations and the rich and the powerful and allowing the rest of our communities to fend for themselves. If anything proves that that doesn't work, I think it's Katrina and the aftermath of Katrina. So we're going to be spending hundreds of billions of dollars more than it would have taken initially for the government to provide for infrastructure, for community, for health care, for transportation.
Who pays the price? Who pays the disproportionate price for those things? For the most part, it's going to be working people who do the dying, the suffering, and have the greatest losses.
Adolf Reed made the point that working people will suffer. Up next, Reverend Bruce Wright.
One of the things we have to come to a point of is honestly recognizing the fact that it's not just the natural disaster, but it's in general how our country is run. It's a country where the haves have the right to get what they need in life while the have-nots do not. This thing has kind of opened a gaping wound and made it really obvious that there are really serious distinctions that exist in our country, and that poverty is not just something that can be ignored or is something that's a minuscule part of our culture. It's in fact a whole other culture that is not being brought forth in the national dialogue about what's important in our country. People all around the country are beginning to recognize this, and really all around the world. And my hope is that people will begin to see that the system we have now is bankrupt, that capitalism is a system based on selfishness and greed, and anybody, be they people of faith or not people of faith, can no longer support this system because it ultimately has nothing to do with the people. It has everything to do with money and power.
Jordan Flaherty.
I think it really has laid bare the racism, the treatment of poor people, of working class people in this country. It's made things obvious to a lot of people. It showed even some of these Republicans that this idea of cutting and destroying a social network and a social safety net does not work. This is an opportunity to organize and fight, and to fight with the people of New Orleans, to fight to take the leadership from these community groups and community organizations in New Orleans, to fight this on a mass level. Organize in our own communities and to fight in our own communities to not let this disappear and to not let this be business as usual.
It was a real wake-up call that if we want to have healthy and safe communities that respect our past and have a vision for the future, it is really going to be up to the people.
Walda Katz Fishman ends the program on an important note. It is going to take us all to implement a better future. We must build a society that includes the participation of all. The wealthy people who influence and control our government continue to bolster away at our securities, securities we continue to work and pay for. During these crazy times of climate change, war, and confusion, the government continually increases the profits and securities for the wealthy, but they act as if their hands are tied in times of despair, as revealed by Hurricane Katrina. Part 2 of our Hurricane Katrina program looks at what followed Katrina. We will talk a little about the policing of properties that took place while thousands were still in need, as well as listen to some of our guests share their vision for a new society. Before we conclude, PT Radio and I would like to thank everyone who shared time to talk with us in the midst of this devastating hurricane season. Also, we want to recognize the community radio stations Chaos at the Evergreen State College and Voice of Vashon for their assistance. That is it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. To find out more about Hurricane Katrina, please check out the October 2005 People's Tribune. Every month, PT Radio, in association with the newspaper People's Tribune, the bilingual magazine Tribuno del Pueblo, and Speakers for a New America, attempts to share with you information and visions for a cooperative society, where everyone can have a proper quality of life. To find out more information, please call 1-800-691-6888. Once again, that's 1-800-691-6888. Or visit us on the web at www.ptradio.org. I'm Kenny Shook. Thanks for listening in. Please join us next time for People's Tribune Radio.